And we're live.
Hello, and welcome back to another self-flating episode of the First Time Watchers podcast.
Because we love to watch.
My name is Tim Costa.
This is Walter Vinci.
Armando Da Silva.
What we like to do on the FTW podcast is find a movie that none of us have seen, watch it together, and then discuss. These movies could be new, they could be old, or something that is on all of our lists of shame. And remember to email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com, and stay tuned to the end of this episode for other ways to contact us and to find out what we'll be discussing next week. In this episode, we will be breaking down Ben Affleck's newest film, Argo. But before we get into that, it's time for Yay or Nay. Yay! This is the part of the show where we discuss what we have seen recently on our own. Walter.
I saw Taken 2.
Why?
Because I saw the first Taken.
So?
I like Luc Besson.
Okay.
And then I realized how much I absolutely hate Olivier Megaton. Olivia Megaton
Transporter 3
should not be allowed to direct any more Luc Besson movies. He's had two shots and he's failed both times. This movie, as much as I loved the first Taken and it's such a movie that's near and dear to my heart, this movie is an absolute nay.
Is it a complete disaster?
Liam Neeson can't even save it.
Wow.
It's the story. I'm surprised Luc Besson wrote it. He's one of the co-writers. I think it's
Robert
him and
Mark Heyman.
Yeah, Mark Heyman. And this movie is boring. It is one of the most boring movies I've seen all year. It's dull. The plot is basically Liam Neeson and Famke Jensen. Liam Neeson plays Brian, Famke Jensen, Lenore. They get kidnapped, and Kim just narrowly avoids getting taken, you know, a second time. And so he has like a little mini cell phone in his sock, and Kim's like, I can help you guys. I can do this. I know I can. So he's giving her, like, instructions, like, how to, like, find where he is, because he, you know, he's got a blindfold, but he's counting seconds to see how far he is away from the hotel where he gets abducted from. And then it's so, like, the fight scenes, Olivia Megaton needs to learn how to shoot fight scenes, because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. Everything is like you see a wide shot of a bunch of guys with clubs, and then it's like a super tight shot of just two people's wrists. Like, he's like someone's hand is on someone else's forearm, like, pushing him back. And then, like, the guy's, like, against the wall. He's, like, oh, he's been thrown, and Liam Neeson standing alone again. Another guy tries to take a shot at him. It's, like, another, like, underneath, up close, you know, angled shot. And I'm sitting there going, I have no idea what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing fists and knees, and I don't know whose they belong to.
Now, do they even explain how Famke Jensen is along for this trip? Because...
Yes.
Okay.
That was my first question when I saw the trailer was... Yeah. She's married to someone else, but apparently at the beginning they establish that she's having marital trouble.
Oh, okay.
You know, that they're going through like a thing.
So she decides to go on vacation with her ex-husband.
She was supposed to go on vacation with Kim, and played by Maggie Grace, and they're supposed to go to China together. But then the husband, you know, in his big douchebag move, decides to pull all the funding for their trip. So now they can't go on vacation together and have some mother-daughter time. So of course Brian Mills, played by Neeson, is like, well, I can help you out. I'm going to Istanbul for 2 days to do a job, and come join me.
How convenient.
Exactly, come join me. And, I don't know, you know, Brian Mills, I have to ask you, you are a preventer. You've been all around the world, you've seen the worst that terrorism has. So you would go to Turkey?
Yeah.
You'd bring your family to Turkey?
Yeah.
What did you expect to have happen?
Yeah.
So
there's nothing redeeming about this movie?
I couldn't find anything redeeming about this movie, like... I think the funniest part of the whole experience was sitting in the theater, and there's a part early on when him and Lenore are captured, and he makes his escape. He's making the escape. He leaves her behind. He's like, "I'll be back, Lenny," and he leaves and he goes and he, you know, kicks some ass, and basically he just runs around the block like twice in this whole movie. That's like that's the extent of like the radius of everything that happens. He runs around the block. So by the time he gets back to Lenore, she's gone. they've moved her to somewhere else. So he's got to chase her down. But when he finds her again, he lays her down and goes, "I'll be back, Lenny." I hear people behind me going, "You just said that 10 minutes ago. Look what happened."
Wow. So let me ask you, how do you explain this movie making $50 million in its opening weekend and coming in number two the following weekend and has a total of $89 million domestic, and it's actually grossed higher than the original Taken worldwide at $224 million?
All right, what's its Metascore?
Oh, Metascore, that is like 45, I think.
And IMDb score?
6.7.
That's unbelievably generous. This movie deserves the 12% it got from Rotten Tomatoes. I love action movies. There's action in this, but it's bad. It's not good. I think the reason why it's number two is that people know the first Taken, which kind of came under the radar thing for a lot of people who are action fans.
But how does it continue through to become the number two?
I think there's a lot of Johnny Come Latelys are like, hey, what do you want to go see? Well, we can go see Frank. We can go see Taken 2. I wanted to go see Taken 2.
Well, you would think that bad word of mouth would prevent people. It's really interesting to me.
Yeah, the user rating is only like, 56% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, I haven't checked that yet
for this movie. So I think it's more what it is. A lot of people just say it's like, you know, curiosity. To go see, like, oh, I saw the first movie, it kicked so much ass. Oh, let's go see this movie. It's got to kick so much ass again. No, it doesn't. And Olivia Megaton, if you're out there listening to this.
59% user on Taken 2.
Olivia Megaton, if you are out there, you need to not do action movies anymore. Do something not action, because, like, I can't figure out what the hell you're doing or what your vision is. So Taken 2 is a nay all the way.
Interesting. All right, Hermano?
Okay. I rewatched Prometheus.
And why did you rewatch Prometheus?
Because I loved it. as soon as I left the theater, I'm like, yep, when that comes out on Blu-ray, I'm getting it. Because I definitely wanted to see it again, because I felt like that's one of those movies that you need to see again. And I gotta say, watching it the second time, I loved it even more.
Yeah.
Wally was saying right before we started recording that he thought it was boring.
I did.
And, I couldn't disagree more. Like, I love this movie. I remember initially people were complaining about, oh, you know, I felt like this movie was put under, like, the biggest microscope.
Well, look at the pedigree it's coming from. You know, exactly. The director of the original Alien.
Yes, and Blade Runner. And you know, it's his first sci-fi movie in forever. And
it takes place in the same universe as Alien.
Yes. And I honestly don't know what people are complaining about. I mean, I think the main nitpick people were pointing to were like, oh, the scientists in this movie are dumb.
There are a couple of dumb scientists.
Technically, they're not scientists. One's a geologist and the other one's a botanist.
Still, they do a couple of dumb things.
They do something dumb, yes. But, I mean, it's like people like complaining about people in horror movies do dumb things. Like, if they didn't do dumb things, there wouldn't be a movie.
Well, name somebody in Alien who did a dumb thing.
Everybody?
You think in the original Alien, you think they did dumb things?
Yes.
Oh,
Sam, I think there were characters that did dumb things. I think that in Alien, they were confronted by something they didn't understand and basically went about it.
And
one
they're
way.
Not scientists; they're just crew. They're just like miners.
Well, these people weren't scientists either. One was a geologist. Well, he literally
they're educated people.
Educated. I would argue that people in horror movies are educated and they still do dumb things. People are people. That's human
teenagers?
Nature. No, not there aren't always teenagers in horror
movies. Most of the time, they're teenagers.
No, they're not. But. Regardless of that, I don't think that's valid at all, because it's two people in the entire movie, and it's what people gravitate to. It's bullshit. Anyways, the rest of the movie is fucking phenomenal. The performances are amazing. I actually got to see the alternate opening and the alternate ending, and I definitely think the original theatrical beginning and ending is far superior. The ending, and I don't want to spoil it for you guys, because you guys are initially going to want to see it, but they just add stuff that I don't think really needs to be added. I think leaving it ambiguous or vague was the right call in the theatrical version. And hell yeah, I'm going to say yay on this. I think it's awesome. I think it's one of the best sci-fi movies to come out probably since like Blade Runner and Alien.
Holy
and like
crap.
The Matrix.
Wow.
So a lot of the advertising for the Blu-ray says that this will answer a lot of your questions, I guess, with the special features and whatnot.
The beginning starts off with something that, you know, they shed a little more light on what's going on. And I know before I had a hard time figuring out what was happening in the beginning. Like, I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen the movie. But and also at the end, they just give you a little more exposition as to what a character is going to do.
Is that added into the movie itself? Or
no, it's deleted scenes.
Oh, okay.
There's a ton of deleted scenes. I didn't get to see all of them. I saw three different ones.
So there's no like director's cut or anything? It's just the
theatrical version. There's no option like theatrical version, extended version or anything like that. It's
what's
next.
Well, yeah, I wonder if Ridley Scott's going to do that, because he's done that with a few of his movies recently.
Well, if he did, they didn't actually finish the effects in a lot of these extended scenes. So he would actually have to go back and finish effects and doing all that stuff. So I don't know if they're going to actually waste time on doing that. I think he was happy with the theatrical version. But yay all the way on Prometheus.
And Hermano's Mystery Movie of the Week.
Okay. This one kind of just fell into my lap. I remember a couple weeks ago I mentioned that I had seen Jeepers Creepers, the first one. Mm-hmm. And the second one just happened to be on TV the other day. And I hadn't seen it in a while, so I decided to stick around and watch it. And I still love it. I know it's not a highly rated movie. I think it's like 5 point something.
5.4 on IMDb.
On IMDb, and the Metascore is pretty low,
36.
Too. 36. And I don't know what people are complaining about, man. It's a horror movie. You can't... I mean, to compare it to other horror movies, I can see where people would be like, oh, you know, it's not very good. It's very tropey. It's got all the horror conventions. But for me, there's just a feel to these movies, the Jeepers Creepers movies. Like, I think the... Just being like a new bad guy, like the creeper in the movie. Like, I think he's up there with like Jason and like Michael Myers and stuff like that. For me, he is, because I think the history they give him and they set him up in a way that it just makes him seem like iconic as those characters for me. But I know that's going out there. People will probably crucify me for saying that, but I love these movies. The second one's a lot of fun. This is probably the only time this will ever be said, but as I was watching it this time, I saw a lot of similarities to Moby Dick. Have you guys even seen Jeepers Creepers 2?
No, I haven't seen either of them, actually.
All right.
I think I have, yeah.
Well, you know how Moby Dick's like pretty much a story about obsession and revenge, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and how, you know, if you go to those lengths to get what you want, you may not like the outcome. It's kind of the same in this movie where... basically, it takes place like right like a few days after the first one takes place, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but basically something happens to a family, and the father and the son in that family just go out for revenge, trying to capture this guy. And you can almost just compare the creeper to Moby Dick and the father to Ahab, because just the length, this guy, the father is totally obsessed, totally just tunnel vision. Cannot see, like, he's willing to sacrifice everything and anything to get revenge on this thing, and it's intense. Like, I there's this other aspect to the movie which I didn't like as much, which it's about a bunch of like
basketball
players on a bus, and you know that I could have done without. I would have loved to see more of just the father and his quest for revenge, but I highly recommend this movie. It's a B movie made by Hollywood, and it's better than your average B movie, so I say yay on it.
Yay, full on yay.
Yeah, I love them.
All right. All right, so I have a couple movies to mention. The first is The Hours. Now, this is the 2002 film starring Meryl Streep, Nicole Kidman, and Julianne Moore. And Julianne Moore... I'm sorry, not Julianne Moore. Nicole Kidman plays Virginia Woolf, the author.
Okay.
And this movie is told in, like, in three different time periods. Virginia Woolf back in the, looks like the 20s, then the 50s, and the present day of when it was filmed, you know, 2001. But and it's how one of the books that Virginia Woolf writes affects the lives of a family from the 50s on through the present day. And honestly, the movie isn't for me. It's not a movie made for people like us. It's okay. A movie made for women, and so it's not that I hated it. I just found myself a little bit I don't know, drawn out of the movie, because, like I said, it's not for me. So it is interesting. You all right there?
Swallowing water. Yeah, I think I'm good.
You sure?
Yeah, I think
you're so. Positive. Okay. So, yeah, however, I will say that Nicole Kidman as Virginia Woolf, she won an Oscar for this. She won Best Actor for this. And she was a phenomenal. She was really good, because she actually, you know, didn't even look like Nicole Kidman, like herself, because they put on a prosthetic nose and she looked really frumpy because Virginia Woolf had a lot of mental issues, and she really portrayed that very well. However, I don't think that they spent enough time on her character. I would have found the movie a lot more interesting if they just focused on Virginia Woolf and her character and not try to make this sprawling emotional story. All the performances are fine. You know, Ed Harris is in this movie as well. He's great, as always. But he has a smaller role. And Julianne Moore plays the character that in the part of the movie that takes place in the 50s. And she also shows up as an old lady in the present day. And it's all old person makeup. Now, I will say that I think it's the best old person makeup I've ever seen. But despite that, you can still tell it's Julianne Moore wearing old person makeup. So that was a little bit odd. So I'll have to give it a meh, only because it's it has a certain audience. And that I think that audience would really appreciate it. There's audiences like us that would not appreciate it. The only reason I had it in my queue is because I remember Nicole Kidman getting rave performances, and I was interested or in the mood for some sort of drama or whatever. So, meh on the hours. All right. The other movie I watched, I think I can describe in two words.
Tetsuo!
You finally saw Akira! Kaneda! You finally saw Akira!
Tetsuo! Kaneda!
Oh, so you saw the cheap... You saw the lousy dub one.
No, I didn't.
No, because it's Kaneda, not Canada.
Whatever, I'll pronounce it wrong.
Terrible.
The original dub has it as Kaneda.
So, obviously I saw 1988's Akira. I gotta say, this movie's pretty incredible. It's pretty good. It's amazing, the scope of this movie. You know, the animation is phenomenal.
Dunwood Cells.
Huh?
Dunwood Cells.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Now, looking back on two movies of this year, Chronicle and Looper, I can understand the you know, looking fondly back at Akira, making some comparisons and whatnot. Especially Chronicle. I can definitely understand why you guys would say that's the closest we'll ever get to a live-action Akira.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that got me to thinking of the remake that's still somewhat in the works, I guess. And, what's his face? Keanu Reeves. There's only two characters I could see Keanu Reeves playing, and that's the Colonel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Or Ryu, one of the underground people who, yeah. You know, rebels.
He's far too old to play either. Yeah, to play.
Right, you need to have teenagers. There's no way, you know, if they're going to set it in like a neo New York and have Americans, that's fine, whatever, as long as you get the tone up. But anyways, it's interesting though. There is some Japanese sensibilities, you know, storytelling wise, that takes a little bit of a hurdle to get over. You know, especially in the first half of the movie, they go out of your way to not explain anything to you,
yeah.
And I find that in a lot of Japanese movies, and it only comes together and coalesces in the end. You know, and that's fine. It's just odd getting used to that when you're used to an American movie, but. There's a lot of really cool ideas and things in there.
What do you think of the monster morph at the end?
Pretty incredible. Once again, got me thinking they'll never be able to accomplish this in a live action. They have to rewrite it somehow, you know? It's pretty incredible. It's quite amazing. Now, I know, Hermana, you had this in your top 10 movies of all time.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was the first anime I ever saw, and it pretty much made me see every anime that I've seen since is because of Akira.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It opened my eyes to like animation like that I'd never seen like that, and it blew me away, and it got me to see all these other great movies because of it.
I think that this is probably the limit of craziness that I would be able to take. I think anything crazier than this movie when it comes to what happens and the ideas behind it, I just wouldn't be able to get myself fully invested in it, you know, despite how great the animation or storytelling might be. There's some pretty wild ideas, you know, that go beyond simple telekinesis, you know, or psionic abilities. I think anything beyond that, I've heard that there's some pretty crazy anime out there.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to give you two recommendations for anime since you've got, you know, the taste of Akira, two more that I can highly recommend.
The first, I think you should see after this, would be Ghost in the Shell,
I've heard about
which
that.
Is one of my favorite animes of all time.
Actually, I don't think I have that on DVD.
And also, I'd also recommend Ninja Scroll.
Ninja Scroll.
Yes, yeah, Ninja Scroll.
But I have it on...
It is another awesomely animated... Ninja Scroll is a samurai story, and Ghost in the Shell is sci-fi.
Okay.
But I think Ghost in the Shell would really strike a chord with you. I think you'd really like that one. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay, fair enough. You may be hearing me talk about it sometime in the future.
Hope so. If you want to borrow it, I got it on disc.
Okay. So Akira, I'll give it a... I'll give it a yay. okay, so that does it for yay or nay. Let's move on into trailer hitches. This gives us an opportunity to mention a trailer that either gets us on board for an upcoming movie or makes us want to bitch. Walter.
I saw Broken City, starring...
You mean the trailer for Broken City?
Trailer for Broken City, starring Mark Wahlberg and Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm.
Boring. It's another one of... It looks terrible. Russell Crowe in this stupid wig. it's hair in the movie. Basically... Mark Wahlberg's a former cop, and you see him, like, scraggly beard with his badge on his neck, and you hear shots fired, but you don't see anything of what he's done. You just see him standing there with a gun, and you hear helicopters coming. And then, apparently, he leaves the force, and Russell Crowe is the mayor, and he hires him to take photos of his wife, who he suspects to be cheating.
I guess that's Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Played by Catherine Zeta-Jones, and he does, and then... You know, apparently the mayor is evil and doing evil things with these photos. Like, he's using him as a means of... putting hits out on people that he doesn't like. So, you know, Mark Wahlberg was like, I'm not going to play this game. And then he's like, I own you. And he plays like somehow he has a video and audio copy of like the actual shooting that takes place at the beginning of the trailer that if he were to release it would get Mark Wahlberg in a lot of trouble. So now Mark Wahlberg's got to find a way to stop the mayor and take him down before it's too late.
Oh, okay. I get this now. So the director is Alan Hughes. Of the Hughes brothers.
Okay.
So he directed, I'm sorry.
Book of Eli.
The Book of Eli. And Menace to Society and Dead Presidents. And a documentary called American Pimp, which is very good. And From Hell as well. These are all pretty, pretty decent movies. So
this story alone looks like it's so contrived and so boring and so I've seen this movie. I've seen it in a number of video games and I've seen it on like just numerous like TV shows. It doesn't look like it's going to bring anything different to the genre. It doesn't look like it's going to do anything cool or fun. It's just going to be Mark Wahlberg just running around staring intently at things and you know yelling at people periodically and Russell Crowe being like, ha ha, I'm an evil mayor.
Oh, interesting. So it's written by a guy named Brian Tucker. This is his very first screenplay. This is it. This is his only credit on IMDb.
Congrats, Brian Tucker. I'm not a fan of yours yet. it's the trailer, bitch. I might end up seeing it like one of those days where I'm like, I have nothing to do. I need to get out of the house. So might as well go to the movies.
Or you could wait for DVD.
Yeah, or I could wait for Redbox. You know, whatever. It looks like a Redbox movie. That's the best way to put it.
Interesting. Hermano.
I saw the teaser trailer for the Carrie remake. I gotta say, when I heard that this movie was being remade, I said right away. Mm-hmm. But after seeing the teaser trailer, they hooked me. Because it was pretty effective. Basically, a teaser trailer is nothing more than a helicopter shot through a main street of a town. And you start to see one building burning, and then there's cars on fire, and then there's other buildings on fire, and it's just like this long fire trail, and the camera zooms in at the end of the trailer, and you see Carrie covered in blood, and it's starring Chloe Moretz, I think, what's her name, redheaded actress you just mentioned her in the other movie.
Nicole Kidman?
No.
Her, Julianne Moore?
Julianne Moore. Mm-hmm. She plays the mother, I believe, of Carrie, so... Great casting, and the trailer hooked me. I mean, it was really effective. I mean, just as the teaser trailers go, it's one of the better ones I've seen in a long time. So, I mean, this is one of those cases where, you know, initially I thought, what a bad idea, but now
I mean, the teaser trailer was okay. I'm not, you know, it's not much to say that, you know, we don't know how the movie's going to turn out.
So, the original movie, directed by Brian De Palma, 1977? Was it 76?
Something like that, yeah.
Quite good. You know, of course, considered a classic, and Sissy Spacek is remarkable.
Kind of a female Akira.
Okay. So, that's a good comparison. So, yeah, Brian De Palma, definitely you saw his touches. He has a definite aesthetic, a directing style that you can see in a lot of his movies.
Yes.
And it's utilized well in this movie. This the remake is directed by Kimberly Pierce, who directed Boys Don't Cry and an episode of The L Word and Stop Loss. So this is a very interesting choice, I think. It seems to me maybe she'll bring forth this female attitude, you know, that'll really, really embody what Carrie is going through in this movie, you know, and something that Brian De Palma was able to touch upon in his version. So the director, certainly, is very interesting. Good choice, I think.
Yeah. And I'm hitching to it because, you know, like I said, it looks okay.
Looks okay. cool. So the trailer that I just saw, or actually we all just saw, is the latest Jason Statham actioner called Parker, and it's also starring Jennifer Lopez, and gotta say, it looks pretty shitty.
Oh, Tim.
It looks pretty shitty.
I just heard Wally's heart snapping around.
I mean, because, you know what, this doesn't look like anything different than any other typical
Jason Statham movie
from, you know what it reminded me of? I remember watching the trailer for The Mechanic and being like,
I was just watching The Mechanic before I came here.
Hey, this looks pretty decent. Why didn't you talk about it?
I didn't finish watching it.
and what was the one with Robert De Niro that he was in?
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
I have it at home.
Yeah, oh, you do? Jesus Christ.
Dude, I haven't had Jason Statham collection at home.
Oh my God. Killer Elite.
That's right. That movie was... Well, that's one I don't have, because I refuse to buy movies that are just absolutely god-awful. I will not reward mediocrity.
Even if it's... Then how do you even tolerate The Mechanic?
I like The Mechanic.
It's an awful movie. It's terrible. And this movie, Parker, doesn't look anything different. I don't know what to say. It's just has Michael Chiklis in it and Jennifer Lopez.
I saw Nick Nolte in it for
Nick
a second.
Nick Nolte's in it, that's right. Clifton Collins Jr. I mean, oh my God.
He doesn't really stray much. I feel like he has more range than that.
Who?
Jason Statham.
Yes,
he
does.
You think he has range?
He'd watch the movie London. Watch that. It's
Jason. I have seen the movie London,
yeah,
and there's
awesome.
Not much range in there.
He was great in like Scratch and stuff like that. I mean, yeah, Snatch.
Scratch was
the sequel to Snatch.
He's great. I mean, granted, he's like my action hero right now. You know, but I think he can do a. I think he can do a lot. I think that the thing is that a lot of movie studios want him for action because he sells tickets.
Well, yeah, he sells tickets for movies that come out in January and February.
He sells tickets for movies, period. Expendables?
He wasn't the lone selling point in that movie.
No, but he's the second villain.
That's an ensemble cast.
That
is
definite ensemble cast. You can't count that as a Jason Statham movie.
It's not, but he's second billing in the movie.
No, anybody could have. Anybody in the top seven of that film could have been second billing.
But you never see it that way. It's always Stallone, Statham.
Well, that's because of the way the characters are written, because he's second in command pretty much.
But he's also second billing. I guarantee
it. I think
they
just go in alphabetical, because it goes Stallone, Statham, Schwarzenegger.
What about Lundgren?
Willis.
Lee. What does it come before S?
So I'm looking at the director Taylor Hackford, and did.
That's a terrible name for a director, Taylor Hackford.
Well, look at that. Did he really direct Ray? He couldn't have directed Ray. He did direct Ray. And that's a great movie. Holy shit. And, oh man.
Tim just hitched.
No. I don't know. It just looks so generic and it looks like forced chemistry between him and Jennifer Lopez. He also directed The Devil's Advocate? What
That was awesomely bad.
Yes.
Like, but it was good bad. Like,
yeah.
Al Pacino, Keanu Reeves. Oh, dream team.
So, I honestly cannot hitch my wagon to this movie.
Can't, not even with the fact that in the poster he's wearing a J-Lo t-shirt.
It pretty much looks like a J-Lo t-shirt. It looks terrible. I know. Look at that.
It's a J-Lo t-shirt.
It's just an awful image of half of J-Lo's face superimposed over his suit.
The three of us are all graphic designers of some kind, and
it's just bad Photoshop.
It's just terrible Photoshop. Yeah.
It's lazy Photoshop is what it is.
Like, and
you know what that reminds me of? The Django Unchained poster when I first saw it. It was that level to me.
What are you talking about?
Nothing.
For those unknown, there's an ongoing feud between Hermano and I regarding movie poster quality.
You know the Django Unchained poster? We'll talk about this at a different time.
I
think this is a good discussion we could have.
Yeah. Anyways, so yeah, I'm bitching about the trailer for... whatever that movie's called.
Parker.
Okay, time to move into our review of Argo. The plot. As an Iranian revolution reaches a boiling point, a CIA exfiltration specialist concocts a risky plan to free six Americans who have found shelter at the home of the Canadian ambassador. The director, Ben Affleck. The stars, Ben Affleck, Bryan Cranston, Alan Arkin, John Goodman. Before we get into it, let's talk about Ben Affleck's other two movies briefly. Wally, have you seen his other two movies?
I have. Gone Baby Gone and The Town.
Correct. And your thoughts on those?
I liked Gone Baby Gone. I don't want to say anything because people might say I want to potentially spoil something for them. I loved the ending of Gone Baby Gone, uh-huh. like how it all wrapped up.
Uh-huh.
And I adore The Town.
Adore it.
I adore The Town.
Yeah.
When the movie came out, I was surprised that, if we were doing a podcast then, it probably would have been my top 10 for that year.
Okay.
Probably close to my number one.
Fair enough.
And this movie, I have to say, that I put it up there along with those two movies.
Well, we're not getting it. Don't get it.
I'm just saying. Yeah. You asked me a question. Okay. It's a Ben Affleck movie.
Hermano, his first two movies?
I like them both quite a bit. I think I would actually put The Town ahead of Gone Baby Gone. Just a slight margin. I mean, they're really close for me, but yeah, I think he's done a great job. All the movies he's directed so far.
Yeah, I agree. I'm surprised, actually. I'm rather surprised, shocked a little bit. Gone Baby Gone came out in 2007, and if we were doing anything like this back then, I think that might have been my number one of that year, and I think that's still his best movie to date. Now, I think we'll get into it a little bit later, but I think the main reason that I think it's his best is because he's not starring in it. And he was able to focus his attention on the directing.
Yes.
Which was phenomenal. And I think both that movie and The Town are great love letters to different areas of Boston. You know, and not only that, but also just encapsulates the feeling of Boston and the surrounding towns as well. And not with just the buildings and the atmosphere, but the characters that are in the movie too. Just fantastic. I think especially in Gone Baby Gone, I think he cast a lot of non-actors in that movie
His brother was like the lead.
Well,
I think one of his first movies.
No, Casey Affleck? Oh, no. He's been in tons of movies before then. Anyways, so, and then The Town I really did enjoy. I had some issues with the ending of it. That's why I like Gone Baby Gone a lot more, is because the ending is a lot more ambiguous. And the ending of The Town is a lot more cleaner, let's just say. So as far as Argo, Wally.
I enjoyed this movie.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
You can expound on that now if you'd like.
Oh, well, okay, fine. I knew the story of Argo going into the movie, mm-hmm. and even knowing the actual events that happened, I had never been white-knuckled in a movie for such an extended period of time as I was in this movie, especially the last, half hour, just gripping the side of the seat, going just completely just going like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, you've got to get out of there. You have no idea how dangerous this is. And any movie that can be invested like that, like after the movie was like, was done and I left the theater, I was exhausted because I was that tense. Like, that wound up, like, and that, like, really wrapped up in, like, the whole story of the movie. The way it was shot and, the way, you know, the way it was acted and all that. I was, like, immersed in that world. Like, for, you know, 2 hours, I was trapped in Iran with, you know, 6 other hostages trying to get out.
Hermano?
I liked it quite a bit as well. Like Wally, I was familiar with the story, but only to a certain extent. I didn't know the full details of everything that went down. I liked the movie a lot. I thought the performances were all really, really good. I thought the movie's 2 hours long. I didn't feel like it at all. I was, you know, invested throughout. I do have, like Wally was just mentioning, how he was white-knuckled the whole time and just, like, really tense and everything like that. I think that's where I have my biggest issue with the movie, is with the tension and all the tense scenes in the movie. I thought it was really overdone and super manufactured.
Really?
Yeah.
Super manufactured.
I'll outline the exact scenes I'm talking about in spoilers, because most of them are spoilers because they happen towards the end of the movie. But it's the one time when I was watching the movie, and it was really noticeable to me, and it started taking me out of the movie, these specific scenes that would happen one after the other, if you know what I'm talking about.
Are you talking more towards the end of the movie, or even in the middle of the movie?
No. It felt like way more heavy-handed towards the end of the movie. I felt like they, throughout the movie, there was tons of, you know, tense scenes because of, you know, the situation they're in. I mean, these hostages stuck in Iran. You know, the CIA is going to come in and send, and they come up with all these, like, bogus plans to try to get them out. And, you know, Ben Affleck comes in and is just like, no, all those plans are bullshit, whatever. And right from the moment he gets there to Iran to try to take these hostages out, I thought that they just started manufacturing tension over and over and over. And it was like, it was total Hollywood tension.
There was one element of tension regarding a character, one specific character, that I agree with you was manufactured and was not necessary. But otherwise, yeah. I don't know if I agree with you about that.
Well, the reason I say this is because I think a lot of the scenes were obviously, they took some creative license.
Well, because we'll get into that later, because they took a lot of creative license.
Exactly. And I think most of the time they took creative license, it was to build tension.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because I bet if you go look at the story, it was a lot. I mean, I'm not going to say it was easy, because that's undermining, you know, what these people went through, but I will say that I bet you any money that half the stuff that was depicted in this movie did not actually
happen. Tell you right now, if you go to Slate.com, there's an article by David Haglund, and the article's called How Accurate is Argo? And he details, with spoilers of the movie, you know, spoilers of real life as well, parts of the movie compared to real life. And it's very, very interesting. I strongly encourage people to go and read this movie, especially if they want to know how accurate this is and what really, really happened. And we may get into some of those details later on.
You know, that's it. I mean, there was one other thing. I guess I could just mention it now. Did anybody else notice Michael Parks is in this movie?
Michael Parks?
Yeah. You blinked and you could have missed it.
Huh.
Who's Michael Parks?
Michael Parks, he was in...
No, I mean, wait, who was he in the movie?
Oh, who was he in the movie? You know who he is, though. Yeah. All right, you know that point where Ben Affleck... There's a point where Ben Affleck, I think, is in his office, and this guy walks in and gives him some storyboards, and Ben Affleck looks at him and is like, can you make this look more... I forget what he says, like more... what does he say? He wants to look a specific way, and he tells the artist to do it. That guy was Michael Parks.
Wasn't he in Martha Marcy Mamre Lane? Was he the...
No, he was John Hawks, he was in Red State.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He was the preacher in Red State.
Okay.
And he was also in, like, a couple of Quentin Tarantino movies. He was in...
Yep, I know who you're talking about.
He's a great, great actor.
Uh-huh.
And to have him just walk on, it felt like literally like 5-10 seconds, just hand something to Ben Affleck, spout one line, and then just never be seen again. I'm like, what the hell was that?
Well, maybe it was just meant to be a cameo. Maybe it was just meant to be like a favor to Ben Affleck or something. Maybe they have some sort of relationship.
Dude, I don't get it. Like, why hire? And that's like hiring, like, you know, like George Clooney. Hey, just come in 5 seconds, say something.
I bet you stuff like that. Well, first off, George Clooney.
He's not George Clooney, but okay. I'm just saying. Like, to me, he's great, and I'm like, you don't hire a guy like Michael Parks for this part.
As far as recognition wise, maybe he's on the same level as Ed Harris. You know?
Sure.
So maybe it would be the same as having Ed Harris do that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you could find other movies that have done this. Other directors that have done this.
You guys didn't even notice it. He was on the screen for like 5 seconds.
Okay.
Like, what is up with that? I mean, they got Bryan Cranston in this movie. They got like Alan Arkin, John Goodman. I mean, those guys are great too. But I'm like, you don't hire Bryan Cranston to do that. Why would you hire Michael Parks to do that?
Well, like I said, maybe it was just some sort of favor. I think you're just nitpicking right now.
I find something I'm going to say to Romano. He's going to go, what? But I didn't notice Michael Parks in the movie. But I noticed the Snickers kid in the movie.
The Snickers kid?
Yep. The Snickers kid that turns into Joe Pesci with the curly hair. He's the PA on the movie that the fight scene is going on that he won't let...
Oh, my God.
He won't let John Goodman cross.
You noticed that? You didn't notice Michael Parks?
I didn't notice Michael Parks.
Holy shit. You know what else I actually noticed was... you've seen Monsters, right?
Yes.
Have you seen Monsters? One of the terrorists. The hostages was the main guy in... Monsters. The guy with the mustache, the guy that at first doesn't go along with Ben Affleck.
Yeah, the guy who looks like
David Cross. My wife.
Yeah. That David Cross from
Glass. That's what I thought he looked like too. Is David
Tobias?
Cross.
He looked like Tobias.
I guess.
Oh my god. Yeah, I got to tell you, I think this movie deserves an Oscar nomination for editing. I think the editing in this movie is beautiful because that's how you create all the tense moments in this movie, and it's because it's intercut with events that are happening in America and then Iran at the same time, you know, that are somehow intermingled. They mean something for each other. It's beautiful the way the movie is edited. It's amazing. I love the score too. The score is really, really good. It really brings out those tense moments. It's not overwhelming. That's one thing I forgot to talk about in the hours is the score was atrocious. It was so fucking annoying. It was just it just made me want to tear my hair out. It was insufferable. Because it propelled you from scene to scene through the score. The score was telling you how you should feel at that moment. In this movie in Argo, it was so understated, but it was also really tense at the same time. It was just under the scenes. It wasn't over the scenes. You know how you can tell that with the movie? And I thought it was great.
What did you think about the Led Zeppelin in there?
I didn't recognize it. I don't know.
You don't even like Led Zeppelin.
No, I hate Led Zeppelin.
Of course you wouldn't recognize it, you punk.
I think they're way overrated. Anyways, camera work. You definitely see a difference in this movie than his first two movies.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot more close-ups and the filtering in this movie, especially at the beginning when they show the old Warner Brothers logo and the old font style for Argo.
Yep.
And he's got that film grain. You got that film grain all over the place. Great. Really gets you in that setting.
It brought back a lot of memories, that old Warner Brothers logo.
Oh, man.
Anybody that grew up in the 80s just is like, must have been just creaming. Like,
yeah.
And the kids who grew up now, like, the hell is that?
The hell's that goofy looking logo?
I know. Did they change their logo again? What the hell?
Yeah. It's a weird typeface.
It's just like a dot and two lines.
I remember watching Dukes of Hazzard and that would always play at the end, and I'm like, yes, Dukes of Hazzard.
However, did you notice that the opening of this movie shows, you know, the Iranians protesting at the U.S. Embassy? Mm-hmm. Did it go on a little too long for you?
No. I think that I thought it was really short, actually, compared to, like, the what they were trying to establish at the beginning of the movie. Like, the general unrest that was in the area in 1979. And, I think it felt a little... hasty. Like, it went from like the storyboard about what happened with the Savak and Mossadegh. And
oh, well, no, that was awesome Calabria. Going up until that.
The
but then there was the.
But then it cuts to like just the people outside the outside the tank. And I didn't think that didn't last that long. It only lasted to me. It only felt like a few minutes.
No, I loved the opening narration. I loved the way the movie opened, especially with the narration and just kind of setting up the story, like, you know, up until where the movie starts, which is like present day, I guess, in a. I love that opening, and then I thought I think it went on a little long because they just got a lot of wide shots of everyone
protesters.
In the street. I think they wanted to give you a good idea of like how many people were out there and the scope of what's going on.
They also intermixed that with it looked like actual footage from the era, whether they had cameras there or not, or maybe they were recreating it.
They recreated. I think
they recreated
it.
They
did through photography. Yeah.
Yeah, because by the end credits, did you stick around?
Well, no. I'm talking about the motion video that they had.
Yeah.
The camera, not the still photography. They had motion that looked like the old stock photo video.
You know what? If you can't tell, it's a credit to the filmmakers. Absolutely. Because it's either an incredible recreation or it's stock footage that they had somehow had, and that'd be amazing, you know, if they recreated it that well.
Agreed. Now, the acting performances. I wish Ben Affleck would have chosen somebody else to play his role.
Someone who looked more like Tony Mendez.
Well, yes.
Would have been nice.
Because
at
the end of this movie, they show, this isn't a spoiler, they just compare the actors and the photos of the actual people at the end of this movie. And they did a remarkable job of casting this movie.
Yes.
And using makeup and the everything else, the mustaches and hairdressers, to make them look like their counterparts. And tremendous, except for Ben Affleck. He's playing an Hispanic person.
A short, heavy Hispanic man.
With
a full mustache.
It looks nothing like him. And last name is Mendez. I mean, what is Affleck anyways? What is it, like Norwegian or something? I don't even know. What is Affleck?
I think he's like Irish.
I think he's Irish.
Is it Irish? Irish. Still.
And that was part of the movie that I went, what? Because they don't really refer to him by name for the most part until he says his full name later.
Yeah.
When he's talking to the skeptic. I forget the character's name. And he's like, my name is, you know, is that really your name? He's like, no, my name is Tony Mendez. And I went, Mendez?
Yeah. Well, it was even before that. It was when the trailers for this came out and I saw who he's playing. I'm like, I just wish he, because now we've had some similar discussions in the past about Ben Affleck's acting, and I think he's fine. He's generally okay. There are worse actors, but there are also much better actors.
Yes.
And I think there's somebody that could have played the role a lot better than him, because I think he's the weakest acting point in this movie, because he does a lot of staring. You know, he's non-emotive. Now, I understand that's what his character is supposed to be, especially in moments when he's with the people he's trying to protect. He doesn't want to alarm them, but he barely even does anything with his eyes. You know, there's other actors that could act with their eyes alone and make you feel how he's really feeling.
I disagree. Now, appearance aside, I thought his performance was totally fine. Yes, look at the caliber of acting he's going up against. Of course he's going to be the weak link. I mean, beside, you know, some of the more minor characters like the hostages and stuff like that, but didn't have much else to do. He's carrying the movie. Now, as far as you saying that you didn't see anything in his eyes, I disagree. And there's one scene specifically where I disagree. Now, when he arrives at the Canadian embassy and the hostages are there, they're hiding out in with the Canadian ambassador. And there's a point where he has to convince them to go along with his plan. And he's like, trust me, like, you guys got to trust me. You got to learn your roles that I'm going to give you, and I'm going to get you out of here. And then there's a point where they all go out into the car, and you see it in his eyes that he doesn't quite know if I feel like he's kind of lying to them, because he doesn't know for sure that this plan is going to go through. And I looked at it, and it was very subtle, but it was there. Like, for me, I totally bought it, because he's this kind of this guy that's like, he feels like he's lying to them, and he just lied to these people, and he told them to trust him. And he doesn't even trust himself. Like, I saw that in his eyes. Like, Mia had the same problem. She was telling me, she's like, I didn't think he was very good. Like, and I was like, I don't know, man. I kind of bought into it. Like, he looked like he was conflicted. Like, he wasn't, like, so sure that he could pull this off. You guys didn't see that at all?
No, I saw that. You're talking about when they're driving the van and they come up to the crowd.
Just before he leaves, and the guy finally believes, and he gets in the car, and the camera just close up on him, and you see him, like, I think he starts the car,
he just kind of pauses for a second,
just like, it's almost like he took a breath without taking a breath, like
this better work.
All right, here we go. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he wasn't really sure.
Well, if that's the only time that you saw that, then I don't know if you saw it at other points in the movie, because if that's the only time, then it's not convincing throughout the whole movie. Then.
Well, I mean, even when he was in the CIA room, like, and he's trying to tell these people that the plans they keep coming up with aren't going to work.
Okay.
And in that moment, he seemed like the type of guy that he's kind of cocky and brash, and he, you know, he's like, no, go along with my plan. That's what's going to work.
He's the only one that has an alternative plan, you know, because he's the one that's saying, no, that's wrong. And all these other supposedly smart people can't see the flaws in their plans.
And he can, and he seems like so confident, and like that his plan is the best one, and it's going to work. And at that moment, he seems like this guy that's like, you know, he's really sure of himself and confident. And he's like, I'm going to get these people out, no problem. But when he gets there and he sees, like, oh man, like, I think I might have, like, just been talking out of my ass, because this is for real now. I'm here now. Now I got to actually do what I said I was going to do. And I kind of bought it. Like, I bought the fact that he was this confident guy. Like, you know, he's never failed, and he always gets his man. Right.
I agree. It was written well. I just don't think his performance was as top-notch as what an other actor could deliver.
I thought it was perfectly acceptable. I mean, I wouldn't say, hey, give him an Oscar right now, but I, as far as, like, saying
no,
it's the week.
You know what? I'm agreeing with you that it was acceptable. I just wish that he would focus more on the directing, on the other side of the camera.
I've heard an interview that he gave once, and he said, someone asked him the exact same question, like, how come you keep casting yourself in your own movies? And he's like, I love directing, but I also love acting. I love doing both. And why shouldn't I be able to do both?
I'm not saying he shouldn't be able to do both. I just wish that he would. So you're saying it's my own personal preference.
You would rather see him in maybe a minor role in his own movie, not the lead.
No, I would. No, that would be more distracting, to be honest with you.
Exactly. So he can't win. Like, I mean, he likes to act. Like, I mean, what's he going to do?
Just act and don't direct it. But then direct movies. George Clooney does that. Well, no, that's not true, because
he's also been in his own movie.
He has been in his own movies. Which was also a little bit distracting.
I mean, getting back to the point, I don't think he was that bad. I mean, okay. I mean, it's like, look at the level, like I said, look at the level of acting he was up against. It's like saying, like, he was like John Paxson to, like, John Goodman's Michael Jordan. Like, John Paxson was still a great player. You wouldn't say he was bad. But he was elevated by, you know, Jordan. Right, Tim?
So you're calling John Goodman the Michael Jordan of acting?
He was the Michael Jordan of this movie.
Oh, boy. Now, I think this movie is a great example of Hollywood filleting itself.
Oh.
I mean, honestly, it's telling you that Hollywood did a better job and is better than the government and the CIA at solving problems, solving hostage crisis. And what more do you have to do to... It looks like Hollywood is sucking its own dick. I mean, did you see that?
I definitely saw it. I mean, they went out of their way to show more of, like, Hollywood, like, all the hard work they were doing, more than, like, anyone... Like, the CIA. Like, right. I'm sure the CIA had a lot more to do than, you know, Hollywood did. I mean, Hollywood came up with this, you know, this fake script and some fake storyboards and stuff like that. And I guess they had a reading, potentially. I don't know if that was something that they, you know, they took a little license with, or they had that actually happened to try to really convince, you know, anyone that this was a real movie. But, I mean, they went really out of the way to show a lot of the hard work that Hollywood was doing, and not so much that the CIA was doing.
Yeah, a lot of them, Bryan Cranston in the CIA, he was the one that was...
Anytime you saw them, they were just sitting in a chair at a desk.
Or at the last minute fumbling about trying to get in contact with the right person.
Yeah, anytime they showed the CIA, they weren't, you know what I mean? Like, they never showed, like, all the hard work they were doing behind the scenes. You know, they depicted them as, like, they had stupid ideas, they sit at desks all day and talk on phones.
Well, I mean, this also takes place before internet verification of things. So back then, all you had to do was make a phone call and be like, "Yep, I'm a movie company." Absolutely, there'd be no way to verify it, especially if you're overseas.
But what about all the planning beforehand? And
well, yeah, I mean, you would need to create a decent backstory, make sure you got into, like, the papers, and, you know, one of them actually has a copy of Variety on them in the airport, so they use that as part of their cover material. And I mean, back then, if you think when you see that particular scene, all the person does is make a phone call. You know,
yeah,
there's no extensive research.
But the movie just reeks of Hollywood being more creative and better than the CIA or the government trying to accomplish this mission.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you have to do that to make the movie more interesting. I mean, even, you know, in real life, it was more of a Canadian plan than it was the CIA. That's why it's called the Canadian Caper.
Well, I mean, that's the way it, when they arrived back in In America, again, you know, they had to put up that front because it was still a classified mission.
Yeah.
It was only released by Clinton in 97. It was declassified by him.
Yeah, but I mean, the
what really happened?
The Canadian ambassador was actually going back and forth with Canada to get them Canadian passports using an order of council and doing all this, doing a lot more work than they actually even you've ever seen in the movie.
Right, through the help of Hollywood and the guy in the CIA that was cooperating with Hollywood, you know. So
do you really want to depict a movie where it's just showing, you're showing, like, you know, royal couriers?
I understand that it'll be more boring, but yeah. That it's just, I think it was a little overbearing in this movie, you know, Hollywood, you know. Pretty much Ben Affleck letting Hollywood suck its own dick.
I didn't even think about it. All he really did was, that was like anything close or live, was have that long reading where they basically read the entire movie as a press conference.
Yeah.
And it was also intercut with the woman, the Iranian woman, I guess she was like I don't know what she was exactly, but she was reading their demands or whatever.
Yeah, she was a student that was holding one of the...
And that's what I'm talking about, the editing in this movie. That was intercut, like I said, with lining up the hostages, you know, blindfolded, with guns in front of their firing squad. And that was a tremendous scene. That was like, oh my God. That was the one of the two scenes, the ending being the other one, that I was like white knuckled. I was like, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to the set design of this movie. I mean, it really recreates the era to a T. You know, between the clothing and the hair and
hairstyles, of facial hair, it's just the glasses, amazing, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, got to credit. Hopefully, maybe it'll get an Oscar nom for costume design.
It's,
you know,
it's only possible.
Yeah, or production. What do they do? Set production,
production design.
Yeah.
Anyways, there's also a little touch that I loved it that really drew me in is when he like is on the phone with his son and they're watching TV together. He goes to change the channel by turning the knob. I was like, holy shit, I had a TV just like that. That was awesome.
You just dated yourself. Yes, you're old.
Yes, I am. Anything else you guys want to get into before spoilers?
I also like seeing the old newsreel footage of the time. I remember
watching
the news with my grandparents when I used to stay at their house. I mean, at the time I was like, what, 5? Not really comprehending what was going on. But I remember seeing Jimmy Carter on TV. I remember seeing the Reagan election.
And Tom Brokaw.
Tom Brokaw was, you know, with brown Bronco hair.
Ted Koppel.
I remember seeing all these people on TV. And as an added note, that the crisis ended, you know, within a few minutes after Jimmy Carter switched, you know, stepping down from presidency and Ronald Reagan taking over.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed seeing like all those intercut things, like when people are watching TV and you're seeing actual news footage from, you know, from 1979, 1980, where the people with the protest signs, like, they gotta get the hell out of our country.
Yeah.
That was a nice touch.
And it was kind of reflective of, you know, kind of the times of now, of being scared of, you know, anybody from the Middle East, you know? You see a lot of...
Parallels.
Parallels, yeah, very good. Spoilers that are... Anything else before that?
No, good. Nice.
Okay, spoilers. I found the ending a little bit too manipulative, didn't you?
I thought the ending was excessive.
Now, when I talk about the ending, I mean the whole being caught in the airport and being interviewed and everything from that point forward. You know, especially with, you know, the after they get on the plane and then them the Iranians trying to get the cars and break through the gates and all that kind of stuff. It's a little excessive.
Yeah, I felt it was excessive too. I mean, knowing that they left, you know, they left the embassy, got in a van, drove to the airport, got on the plane, and left.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now this is what I'm talking about. Like, I actually loved that scene. It was one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, where they got stopped at that checkpoint.
I love that. So that's what ratchets up the tension for me, where they're being interrogated and you're waiting to say, oh, someone's got to pick up that phone, it's ringing.
Well, you know? Not that scene. I'm talking about the scene where they're showing the guys the storyboards and, you know, everyone's getting kind of heated and talking, and then all of a sudden that guy reveals that he can speak their language and he's like explaining what the storyboards are and what the entire plot of the movie is.
Which is a callback from the beginning, because they mention it in the CIA briefing that he can speak Farsi.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that scene. But like I was saying, all those scenes that were incredibly Hollywood manufactured tension was everything that happened just as they were going to the airport. Look at all the things they did to add tension. The CIA, oh my God, we got to get him the tickets. Ben Affleck's going with this thing. We got to get him the tickets. What's next? They get stopped at the checkpoint. John Goodman and Alan Arkin aren't by the phone. They're getting stopped by the Snickers kid.
By the Snickers kid.
And they can't get to the phone to answer the phone to confirm that, yeah, they are making this movie. Then there's, they get in the van. The guy can't put it into gear. Oh my God, come on, they're so close. They're so close, they're almost there. And then they get on the plane and like, oh my God, they've been found out. They get in the cars, they fucking smash down doors, and I'm like, dude, come on. I bet you any money they fucking got on the plane and just left.
That's what they did.
So exactly. Here's what actually happened. That Slate.com article I referenced, which you should read, by the way. Actually, though, the trip through the airport was smooth as silk, as Mendes himself written. Most improbably, the teams of carpet weavers at the Iranian government put together repairing shredded documents, which they actually did.
They actually did.
Yep. Pieced together the face of one of the six Americans right as the group reaches the airport. And those carpet weavers relay the image to their higher-ups in time for armed men to chase down the departing plane and a jeep and police cars. None of that happened.
None of that happened, exactly. Yeah. It was just basically, they walked into the airport, got on a plane, and left.
Right.
And that's what I was talking about before. I was like, dude, that's a little much, man. They just fucking just hammered you over the head.
Which is a test to Tony Mendes in real life. To Tony Mendes in real life. Because
that he was able to get
this done. That there was not a single hitch. Like, sure. He's just like, they walked right through and ghosted right out of there.
Yeah, maybe, because he wrote a book, and maybe in his book he explains a little bit in greater detail. Maybe there was a time when he looked and saw something.
Well, yeah, obviously, that had to have happened. You know,
right.
You know, it's not,
but
gonna,
generally
you're
speaking,
thinking in your head the entire time, like, we're going to get caught. We're going to get killed.
Right.
Like, we have to act totally natural. Like, we, you know, absolutely, we're Canadians.
Right.
And I know it's like, it's almost lame to complain about it because, I mean, if that's what they depicted on screen, they just walk right through the airport, get right on the plane. It's not exciting. It's boring.
Yeah.
But I mean, they didn't have to go,
they went over the top.
They went let's put this here.
Shoot the doors out with the machine gun.
The car's got to get stuck. You know what? Let's get the car, have a flat tire right halfway to the plane. We'll change the tire. And we got to hurry up and do it real fast. Then we'll get on the plane.
They
the plane is out of fuel. Holy shit, we got to refuel.
They should have
the Where's the pilot? Where the fuck is the pilot?
You should have had the plane.
They should have just
the plane
kept
takes
adding
off,
stuff. Like,
plane
go
takes
all the
off
way.
And Ben Affleck's driving the bus, and he's like, they're handing people out, and they're like holding onto the ladders as the plane's reaching the end of the runway. He gets on the plane, and then, where's the pilot? Tony Mendes is the pilot. I've got this, bitch.
They show the pilot, he's zipping up his fly in a bathroom.
He's in the bathroom,
on the other
like,
side of the airport.
You want to ratchet up even more? You put one of the guards on the plane. He's just killed the pilot. And he's yelling in Farsi, like, I found you out! And he's like, Krav Maga! Whap, whap, whap!
That would have been awesome if there was a guard on
the plane. Just made an awesome movie.
But no, like, Ben Affleck actually says Krav Maga right before he does it. He doesn't use it. He just goes, what? Krav Maga! And they go, what? Pa, pa, pa!
He just turns into Jason Statham all of a sudden, just fucking transporter style.
Jason Statham comes out
of kicks him.
Jason Statham comes out of the luggage rack. He's hiding in a box.
Also being manipulative was the whole relationship with his ex-wife and son and everything like that.
That added absolutely nothing.
That barely was even touched up until the end where he shows up at his own house.
You know, I thought that talking with his son on the phone, that was a fine touch. You know, it wasn't problematic at all. You know, and if they wanted to show him with his son again, maybe... maybe on like the steps of the in Washington D.C., like he was with Alan Arkin earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been a decent callback. But with the whole wife, because you don't ever see the ex-wife beforehand.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
like you said, it added nothing.
Like you don't care because you're like, all right, they just briefly gloss over this, you know, here and there in the movie, and then he meets her at the end, and it's supposed to be this emotional thing, I guess. And you're like, I don't even know this girl. Like, she hasn't even been in the movie previous to this. Like,
they're trying to allude that, like, you know, he's having problems at home, maybe because of his job or because of his drinking. Because, like, you see him, like, steal a bottle of alcohol at one point from the Canadian ambassador's house.
Yeah, and that was written for the movie because in real life,
he didn't.
his wife drove him to the airport.
Exactly. Like, he was fine.
I mean, the only part where it made sense is, I don't know if this is how it actually happened, but I mean, at the point where you said he turns the channel and his son, he calls his son and he's watching, what is it, Return to the Planet of the Apes or whatever.
Yeah,
and he's like, all of a sudden he just gets the eureka moment where he's like, hey, Because he up to that point, he had no plan. He didn't have a better plan than any of the CIAs, and that's where he comes up with the plan, like, we'll fake a movie because, you know, his son's watching Planet of the Apes.
Would have been great if they showed Star Trek. Because John Chambers designed the ears for Spock's costume. That would have been cool to see the inspiration, like, you know, Kirk on a desert planet, like when he's fighting the Gorn, and he's like, that's the idea.
All right, did anybody else really want the movie Argo to be made? It would have been one of those movies,
like,
I think.
Like a Flash Gordon.
Like a Flash Gordon, exactly. like a total ripoff of Star Wars.
Well, that's what they were doing back then.
Yeah.
It's an adaptation of a book called The Lord of Light.
Yes.
I wanted it made so bad. When I saw the costumes, like this fake-looking little R2-D2 and like this guy that was supposed to be like Chewbacca or C-3PO or whatever, I was like...
Oh, he's actually a costume bar from the BBC, actually, for Doctor Who. That's I forgot what they're called.
Well, you said Lord of Light, but that...
No, not the Daleks.
That's the script they picked up was actually called Lord of Light.
Yep.
I'm reading from the Slate.com article again. After Chambers showed Mendes the Lord of Light script, Mendes decided it needed a new name. He suggested Argo because it was part of his favorite knock-knock joke. Who's there? Argo. Argo who? Argo fuck yourself. This last phrase is given a different origin story in the movie and becomes a very funny running gag. A little overused.
Yeah, that's going to be my next fantasy football team name, by the way.
Argo, fuck yourself.
It's going to be Argo, fuck yourself.
You're not going to be the only one.
Yeah. Oh, I know. But I'll be the only one in my league.
Everybody in my theater laughed.
Yep.
Everybody in my theater.
Every single time?
Yes.
See, mine, it was waning laugh. At first, it was really funny. It was like, it was like that, pretty much. It was like, all right, dude, seriously? Like,
maybe giggle every time I heard somebody say it.
All right, there was I just remembered this. There was another funny moment. You told me that people applauded in your theater.
Yes.
Did people applaud when you watched it?
No.
All right. I watched the Dartmouth Mall, and it was like probably like maybe 50% full. And right at the end of the movie, one dude just starts going and stops at two claps because nobody else went along with it. And I was like, I wanted to do the Nelson, like, ha ha.
That's funny.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Anything else you guys want to mention?
The little tidbit I had about John Chambers, John... Chambers got John Goodman's character. Was that? I would have been cool to see the Star Trek tie-in.
yeah, maybe it was some sort of licensing rights, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because it'd been cool. Like, oh, look, that's a Star Wars guy. That's the guy who created
John Chambers. You're right.
Yeah, I didn't want to call him like the wrong name. I know there's a porn star with a very similar name.
John Holmes.
That's what I was thinking of.
Could you guys know when you're porn stars?
Why not?
Tim's taking me to school on John Holmes.
So we ready to move on to grades?
Yes.
Well,
I'll give it a B+.
I'll do the same.
I'll give it an A-, so that's a B+ average.
B+ average.
For Argo from the First Time Watchers podcast. Awesome. I'm anxious to see any other movie Ben Affleck comes out with.
Yeah.
I am shocked at his aptitude for directing. I really am, because he was never a great actor. You know,
yeah, exactly.
early on in his career, he obviously developed into a somewhat better actor. And I'm just amazed. Now, maybe I shouldn't be surprised because of his aptitude for writing, which was he won the Oscar for with Matt Damon and Good Will Hunting.
Yep.
But I'm just amazed at how well his movies have come out.
Exactly. I think maybe when it comes to Ben Affleck, I think his talent is writing and directing as opposed to actually acting.
Yeah.
Even though I love seeing him in goofy roles.
And it was good too for him to branch out of Boston finally.
Yeah.
Right. And competently well too, right?
Exactly.
He was the bomb in Phantoms, yo.
Need to watch Jane Silent Bob Strike Back to get that one too.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the First Time Watchers podcast. You can find us on Facebook by searching First Time Watchers. We post movie news and updates that we think you would be interested in.
You also good?
You can email us at firsttimewatchers@gmail.com.
And as I prematurely said, you can also follow us on Twitter at 1stimewatchers@twitter.com.
And we have a Tumblr page, firsttimewatchers.tumblr.com.
And please download our episodes on iTunes and feel free to leave a review. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you have any suggestions of movies for us to watch, please send a tweet, an email, or post on our Facebook page. And stay tuned for our next episode. We will be talking about the 2011 French film, Sleepless Night.
Yeah.
Finally. We were supposed to do that 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, but there's been a problem with us getting the DVDs and being able to see it, so...
Finally.
finally get to check out this movie.
Okay.
And that's the First Time Watchers podcast, because we like to watch.
You guys ever see whatchamacallit? Bukkake tryouts again. You guys ever see The Odd Couple with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon?
No, not in a long time.
Dude, there's a scene where Jack Lemmon starts trying to clear his sinuses, and he goes, they're in a restaurant, and he just goes, "Nya! Nya, 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 nya!" It's so fucking funny, especially the look on Walter Matthau's face, like, "You okay? Do you need to leave?" Oh my god.